The University of Kansas Health System is proud to be the official healthcare provider of the Kansas City Current. From youth athletes to the pros, we put player care first to turn their dreams into reality. Learn more at kansashealthsystem.com/kccurrent.
Border Patrol is presented by Walker Medical Linen Services. Walker Medical Linen specializes in bed linens, towels, scrubs, and lab coats. Family owned and operated for over 140 years. Find out why hospitals of all sizes, surgery centers, and medical clinics trust Walker Medical Linen. Online at walkermls.com.
The Border Patrol continues on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Coming up in the next segment, we'll talk with Annie Rogers of MLB.com, KCRoyals.com, as the Royals did get a series win in Detroit over the weekend, but they opened up their four-game series with the Astros yesterday by blowing a five-run lead and getting walked off with a home run in the ninth inning. We'll get back to the Royals here in a little bit. Want to let you know that today is the last day of voting for the Sports Radio 810 WHB Honorary ESPYs. This is something that we've been doing. I should know this. This is 3 years now. This is the third straight year that we have done this. This is a program. We are an ESPN affiliate here. And ESPN, of course, they do their ESPYs, the nationwide awards, and they came up with the idea a few years ago of bringing that to some of their local markets and maybe making this a regional thing as well, like you see with the Emmys and things like that. And so they tested it in Kansas City and a few other markets, and it won't surprise you that we did better than just about every other market, because that's what happens in Kansas City. You people listening right now, people in Kansas City, rally behind things, they respond, and they support things, especially when it comes to sports in our community. Just like the World Cup bid, just like everything else, that's what we do in Kansas City. We show up, we turn up, we support each other, and we support the local sports scene. And so because our participation's been so good, ESPN, now 3 years in a row, has brought this back. And you can vote for these honorary ESPYs. And these are real ESPY, like you get the real ESPY trophy. Like we get a case of them here, and we'll be passing them out at some point to the people that win these. They're going to get a real ESPY, like it just looks just like it is an ESPY trophy, just like the ones that you'll see at the ESPYs on the national level for ESPN. So if you go to 810WHB.com, you can cast your vote. And voting ends at midnight tonight. Okay, today's the last day to vote, so get there. Midnight tonight, 810WHB.com, our sponsors, Hen House, Wholesale Batteries, Polymagic, Buck Roofing, Amini's, Xfinity Sports Zone, Whataburger, Mike DePasquale and the law offices of DePasquale Moore. Mike's got this. Sandlot Goods, Google Fiber, Metcalf, CarStar, and Office Products Alliance. Those are our sponsors. Here are the categories. There's Female High School Athlete of the Year and Male High School Athlete of the Year. Both, there's a category on the Missouri side and a category on the Kansas side. So there will be a couple of winners in that regard. Female College Athlete of the Year. Male College Athlete of the Year. KC Metro Coach of the Year, KC Boys Metro Team of the Year, KC Girls Metro Team of the Year, Kansas City Fan of the Year. We took nominations for that, and you can see a little bio of each one of those candidates. the clutch performance slash moment of the year. And I think this is one. We can discuss this one real quick, Marco. The clutch performance slash moment of the year. Here are the nominees. Ioka Lee from Kansas State, who set an NCAA single game scoring record with 61 points against Oklahoma in a win. I think that's a significant part of it right there on January 23rd. Okay, so that's one. There he goes. Shane Summers with his Power Cat breathing mask on came in and was cheering from the hallway there for that. Okay, so that's one. Trevor Hudgens of Northwest Missouri State, who drained a long three-pointer in the NCAA Division II Central Region Championship game at the buzzer. There was KU football's two-point conversion in the upset win at Texas. Remember the walk-on tight end who we also had. So far we've had two of the three people on here. We had Ioka Lee on the show. And, boy, I'm going to forget. This is terrible. I've forgotten the young man's name who caught the touchdown pass for Kansas in that the two-point conversion for Kansas in the win against Texas. But he was on the show with us last year when that happened. He was getting an Applebee's commercial and all that stuff. Also, David McCormick scoring two buckets in the final possessions of the NCAA championship game in the 72-69 win against North Carolina. While I was hearing many KU fans griping about David McCormick the entire year and how Kansas threw the ball to him too much in big situations, he was clutch and won the national title there. The AFC divisional comeback win in 13 seconds against the Buffalo Bills. And then there's Jariah Horn, a Barstow grad, in the 2016 DeRena Award winner, netting a buzzer-beating heave from beyond half court for a Tulsa 73-72 win over Central Florida in the regular season finale. We got a Liberty North walk-off hit to win districts. We've got Jaden Wooten of Blue Valley with two buzzer beaters, and Jacob Gilliard of Richmond, former Barstow grad, and the performance he had going for 24 points in an upset win of, I think it was number 2 seed Iowa. I think Iowa was the 2 seed in the NCAA tournament. Any of those stand out to you, Marco? If you got a vote on those, you got one that would get your vote?
Yeah. Maybe the David McCormick, just because how much crud he was taking during the season. And then here's KU going down at half against North Carolina in the national title game. Comes back out, roaring comeback. And then I think it was either Brian Haney or Greg Gurley that talked about if McCormick doesn't have the final 2 minute performance that he has, KU doesn't win the game.
Right.
Against North Carolina. Right. They're not the national champions. So for someone like David, who was kind of the, when you looked at this team, people would notice him maybe fourth or fifth, because there's a lot of other notable Jayhawks that were on this roster this year, especially that helped them get as deep as they did into the tournament, getting the national title game. For someone like McCormick, who overcame the adversity, from now on, no one will remember the regular season, the Big 12 conference during that time. Won't remember McCormick for any of that. It's all going to be what was in those final moments of that tournament game. That's what people are going to remember. That's his legacy at KU, and he could have been arguably could have been the player of the Final Four. Could have been him over Ochai. So
should have been, probably, I think most people feel like.
Yes, exactly. And so I think for him that's who my vote would go to, because it's wasn't the biggest player, but he did it on the biggest stage in the biggest comeback in championship history, and just helped secure KU another national title.
So to me, when I look at these, I see three that stand out. I mean, they're all great performances, and they're all deserving nominees, and it reminds you of how many great moments happened in Kansas City sports over the past year. But the three that stand out to me the most, Ioka Lee, because that's a national record. She did something that no women's college basketball player has ever done before. She scored 61 points in a game, and and beat a top 25 team in the process. You know, if K-State doesn't win that game, maybe that takes a little something away from it, right? Because it still is a team game at the end of the day, and that's what the point of it is. She did that and carried her team to a victory. 61 points in a college game. It's just absolutely ridiculous. So to me, that one stands out. What I think is crazy, I just think this is absolutely crazy, is there's another nominee from an event that happened on the same day. And that was the Kansas City Chiefs beating the Buffalo Bills in overtime, 42-36, when they looked like they had lost the game and went on a field goal drive in 13 seconds to go back and win the game. I think this, if the Chiefs hadn't blown it in the AFC Championship game against the Bengals and gone on to win the Super Bowl, that probably gets your vote right there. To me, like that comeback gets your vote. But I think we'll always remember the 13 seconds here in Kansas City, and we'll talk about it. But it will always come with a different context because they didn't finish the deal, right? Like they didn't go on. It ended up just getting them to the next round, in which they lost. So I think that maybe marks that one down a little bit. But when you think about it from a standpoint of, out of all these different moments, like what's the most unbelievable? What's the most, man, I can't believe that happened? You'd almost say that, like 13 seconds. In some ways, maybe if it wasn't Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs, it would be more unbelievable. But we've seen enough crazy things from Patrick Mahomes. He almost makes you think, well, it's not even that spectacular, because I've seen, every time I watch Patrick Mahomes play, he does three things that I've never seen a quarterback do before. So you almost just, you get desensitized to it. But so I still put that up there. And then, like you said, the David McCormick one, and the reason I think I'm with you, I think I go McCormick on this. Even though, like, what Ioka Lee did was more superhuman. And what McCormick did was hit two big shots. I mean, look, he played a good game overall, but what we're talking about here is the two big shots he hit at the end of the game. A lot of players hit two big shots in games. Like, they, you know, hit that. That's the specific thing that he did was not some superhuman thing that no one's ever done before, coming back in a 13 second scenario or scoring 61 in a game. But it's the context in which he did it. He delivered his team a national championship, you know, in the biggest moment at the very end when they had to have it. He delivered, and his team won a national title because of it. You know, the Ioka Lee situation was a regular season game. Big win for K-State. Very big win. Amazing performance. The Chiefs game was in the playoffs. Big win. But as we know, they didn't make it to the Super Bowl. So, to me, the context, what it did for him, for his university and all that, I think I'm going McCormick as well. But I just thought it would be fun to kind of talk about some of those, because that's not an easy one to me. Like, that's going to be a tough one. There's a lot of great things you can vote for. You just go to 810WHB.com, and you can vote for all of these and many more. And you can also vote, and I think this is really great, for the Kansas City Medical Professional of the Year. Our healthcare professionals, to me, undervalued in our society right now, like a lot of other people. And deserve all the love they can get. So there's some great candidates there for Kansas City Medical Professional of the Year as well. Again, these are real ESPYs that people will be winning, and you can have a hand in deciding who gets them by going to vote. It closes at midnight tonight. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll talk with Annie Rogers about the Kansas City Royals right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
Sugar, strawberries on a summer evening. watermelon sugar high. Watermelon sugar high. Watermelon sugar high. Watermelon sugar high.
That music can only mean one thing. It's time to talk with our Kansas City Royals insider from MLB.com, Annie Rogers. Annie, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Nate. I'm good. How are you?
Oh, just recovering from a holiday weekend. And I'm just curious for you, how blessed and lucky do you feel to have been given the opportunity to celebrate the 4th of July in Houston, Texas?
That's an interesting question. No, it was a great day yesterday. Yes. Very hot here.
It's always it is always hot and humid in Houston, Texas. There's no doubt about that. Hey, look, it looked like the Royals were going to get a big win, or I don't know what you call, I mean, I don't know what a big win is at this point in the season, but it looked like they were off to a win. They were up 5-0. This one they could not hold on to. We've seen a couple of games like that this year. How would you rank this one in terms of disappointments, frustration, all of that, considering how close the Royals seemed to be to getting a win yesterday?
Probably one of the tougher, just based on the context of this series, based on the context of how Jonathan Heasley pitched, how the offense performed in those early innings. That's probably one of the tougher ones. I think they needed to win yesterday's game because they're about to face three, one for sure Cy Young candidate in Justin Verlander on Thursday, and then two other top starting pitchers in the league right now, and Luis Garcia today. And they needed to sneak one away yesterday, and they weren't able to do that because of the bullpen, and the offense went quiet later on in the game. And obviously, this Astros lineup can be pretty dangerous and come back at any time. I think you need like a 7 or 8 run lead, honestly, at Minute Maid Park to feel even a little bit safe. It was definitely disappointing. You could feel it when you walked in that clubhouse yesterday.
And the walks, they're if you're watching these games on a regular basis, they just got to be driving you nuts, especially when it comes to the bullpen. And I know that you don't really have the answer to this, because if somebody did, they'd be able to fix it. But it's like, why can't these guys throw strikes? Why do they continue? I mean, that's just got to be driving the team crazy right now.
Absolutely, and it's just frustrating when you're watching it. Like, it's not as simple as you would just want to say throw strikes and you just yell at the TV probably. But it's not as simple as that. But it is a little bit more simple than nitpicking and. Amir Garrett talked yesterday, and I was interested to hear him say this. And he thinks he's nitpicking at the zone, and that's not who he is. He's a guy who attacks the zone, attacks the hitters, and knows that he's better than whoever walks up to that plate. And he admitted that he's battling himself right now, and I think that's a problem throughout the Royals pitching staff. I can understand the younger relievers, the younger pitchers battling that. I can understand how they see Jordan Alvarez walk up to the plate and know he's the most dangerous hitter in the league and not want to give him anything to hit. But what I can't understand is, Amir Garrett, he's got to throw strikes in the zone, because when he does, he's a pretty lethal reliever. So it has to change. They know that. It can't happen, because that's been their downfall all season. That was the downfall yesterday with those three walks in the eighth inning, and obviously it led to losses. And those are the kind of games they have to win, because Jonathan Heasley was phenomenal in six innings, allowed 2 runs, probably should have been 1 run because of that errant pickoff throw he made. You have to close those games out. That's how you get better. That's how you instill confidence in these young starters, and they didn't do that.
Okay, so I'm interested in what you had to say about Amir Garrett saying that he was nitpicking. I saw this on Twitter back on June 28th, so just basically last week. And I'll admit, I'm not an I don't follow all of these different, I don't know what you call them, services or whatever that it seems that a lot of major league players use now to help them. Kind of, it's almost like, hiring an outside consultant to help you with stuff. But this This Twitter account says Codify Baseball with the blue check mark on it. Said, excited to start working with Amir Garrett. Have been a fan of his work. And we're going to help him learn where best to use those sliders and fastballs to attack hitters in what are truly their weak spots. And I, just because you're so much closer to the game than I am anymore, I'm curious. Their Twitter handle has dozens and dozens of pictures of Major League Baseball pitchers that apparently use this service. How much do you know about this? Does it mean anything, or is this just kind of something that we're going to see more and more pitchers using sources like this from the outside of the organization to try to help them figure out how to approach the game?
I think the latter is definitely true. You're going to see a lot of – we are already seeing a lot of pitchers use outside resources because, you know, they're getting smarter and they'd like to hear different voices. It's just a matter of minimizing those voices. Amir is a really smart guy. He knows what he does well and what makes him one of the better relievers in the game. So he's just trying to get back to that. You know, I think back to 2019, and his slider, it was one of the more effective wipeout pitches in the entire National League when he was with the Reds. I saw him a lot, obviously, when I was covering the Cardinals, and you couldn't hit him. So he needs to get back to that. I think he's just trying to find the right voice to help him. Sometimes it's multiple voices within the team and analytics, and then sometimes it's outside. It's just a matter of who he likes and, you know, what he does best. I think he's a guy who, when he overthinks, it's probably a bad thing for him. He goes up there and just, you know, he needs to let the naturalness take over. And so he admitted yesterday that he's kind of overthinking. He's battling himself and, like you said, nitpicking. So I think it's just a matter of, you know, finding the right fit. And, you know, I watched him talk for a long time yesterday in the clubhouse with Zach Greinke, and I can only imagine what that conversation was like, talking about that slider and where best to put it. So I think he's trying to find the answers, and it's not for lack of effort, that's for sure.
Okay, so, and we're visiting with Andy Rogers. The season when you're 20 games under 500, to me, is reduced a little bit to focusing on some storylines with young players and monitoring their development, seeing if they will continue to grow into building blocks for whenever this team can be competitive again, as well as maybe watching guys like Andrew Benintendi to see if they can continue to bolster their trade value if, in fact, the Royals would be interested in that. So let's get to some of these individual storylines. Heasley yesterday, 6 innings, 3 hits, 2 earned runs, 2 runs, 1 earned, 2 walks and 3 strikeouts. What was the most positive thing you saw from him if you're looking for signs that that he was taking a step in the right direction yesterday?
The mix of his pitches. He threw a steady mix of fastballs, curveballs, sliders, changeups. That's 4 pitches. Last start against the Rangers, he allowed 7 runs in 3 2/3 innings through 3 sliders. That's not going to work. You got to throw all 4 of those pitches. He had a feel for his curveball, which allowed him to have a feel for his slider. He threw about the same number. I think it was 18 sliders and 17 changeups. So just a mix of those kind of pitches. They play off of each other. He had fastball command, which obviously helps the changeup. He threw the kitchen sink. He threw everything but the kitchen sink at the Astros lineup, which you have to do. I was really interested to see him get through that first part of the lineup for the first time, and then have it turn it over. They knew what he had because he threw all 4 of those pitches in the first inning, and he was still able to keep them off balance throughout 6 innings. He pitched out of jams in the 4th and 5th, ended at the 6th with a clean inning in the middle with the middle of their order. So just a really impressive outing from him. He kept them off balance. They didn't really know what was coming. You needed to see that after his start last week against the Rangers, and he came through. And that's why it's so disappointing that they lost, because he pitched really, really well, and that's the kind of pitching you need against that team.
Okay, and then sticking on the pitching front, how do we unpack Brady Singer's last outing? He ties his career high with 9 strikeouts. That's a positive, but he can't get through 5 innings. Where do we come down on what that performance means from Brady Singer?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, he has the strikeout stuff. It's just a matter of limiting those long at bats and the foul balls. I think he's another guy who he's got to attack the zone, and you obviously see that when he does, he's getting the whiffs, he's getting the strikeouts, the called strikes too, with how much movement that Tinker has. So I understand he's trying to get hitters to chase. There are times for that, but more often than not, those pitches fall out of the zone, and then you got 3-2 count, and they start fouling off some balls, and all of a sudden you're looking at long at bats and high pitch counts. So he's got to get deeper. That's the job of a starting pitcher. Is not the 10 strikeouts in a game is great, but or 9 strikeouts, but you've got to get through 5 or 6 innings. That's the job of a starting pitcher, and he knows that. I think it's just a matter of limiting those long at bats. Some of the walks and the several balls that he throws per at bat. I think it's just a matter of limiting that.
We're visiting with Danny Rogers. Let's move over to some of the position players. And obviously yesterday, MJ Melendez, 2 home runs. That's one of the big headliners from the game. And it seemed like he'd been struggling a little bit offensively before this. How significant was that for him yesterday to try to get back on the right track offensively?
Yeah, absolutely. He came into the game with a 2 for his last 23 slump, just struggling really, I think, to put the ball in play. And he had walks in there. He knows how to take his walks, which is great to see from a young guy. But he's got to unleash that power, as we saw yesterday's first home run went to the second deck. It's just an elevated fastball against Odorizzi, dropped his bat. I mean, it was an impressive home run. And then second one, I think, actually went longer, didn't go as high. Really impressive. So absolutely needed to see that. He's got massive power. He's going to unlock that in the major leagues. He's seen it in the minors. He's going to get there in the major leagues. He's going to be a force for the Royals in that lineup for a pretty long time. And very cool for him to have his family there. I think they were there for his last home run too. So I told him, you got to get your family some more games, man. Come on. Get them some tickets. So he laughed at that, and I said, yeah, I'll probably try to do that a little bit more.
Well, and you mentioned him drawing walks, and on that front, Vinny Pasquantino's already showing that at the major league level. He's only hitting 176 through his first 17 at-bats at the major league level. Did get his first hit being a home run over the weekend, but I think this is what you like about Vinny Pasquantino, right? 176 batting average through 17 games, a 417 on base percentage because he's already drawn 6 walks. What have you thought of what you've seen from Vinny Pasquantino and his approach at the plate so far?
I just love the way that he spits on these pitches that are, on the outside part of the zone. And, you don't know if it's maybe a ball or a strike, and then you look at the tracker and it's definitely a ball, and you're like, oh, I've another hitter probably would have swung at that, and he spits on it. It's really impressive, the play discipline that he has. And he's good to get on base once a game, at least, whether it's a single or a walk or whatever it is. Really like the approach he had in the first inning yesterday, too, driving a single up the middle. That was his hit yesterday. And I think it loaded the bases or put 2 guys on base for the Royals to score and right away in that first inning. So he's got a great approach. I think the average will go up as he starts to see more pitchers and understands what they're going to do to exploit him. And but he's he's going to get on base. He draws his walks. He's not going to strike out much, and it's really impressive for a rookie in his first week of the major leagues to do that.
Visiting with Danny Rogers. Okay, any of the you mentioned the pitching matchups that the Royals are going to be facing here over the next couple of days, and they get Zach Greinke going on the mound tonight against his former team. Now he's played for a handful of teams, so I don't know. Is this Zach doesn't usually come across as the most emotional guy. Anyway, is this an emotional return to Houston, Texas for Zach Greinke?
I don't think so. I mean, Zach Greinke is very, he's pretty blunt, and so we'll ask him about it after the game, of course. But he declined to comment on it yesterday, just to a few reporters who came over to the other side and asked for him to talk about his former team. He politely declined. I don't think it's weighs on him at all. He's done this before, whether it's with the Dodgers or D-backs or whatever. He just goes out and pitches. I don't think it's going to weigh on him at all. And I think he's had a lot of good memories here. He obviously pitched well for the Astros, especially in October. I think he's definitely moved on. I know his family's here. They came through and obviously visiting a lot of friends here. So I think that's probably the most exciting part for him.
Well, it should be a good pitching matchup tonight. Zach Greinke against Luis Garcia, as the Royals have game two of the four-game series against the Astros at 7 o'clock tonight. And for all the coverage, make sure that you follow Annie Rogers on Twitter and, of course, go to kcroyals.com, and you can get all of her coverage there as well. Annie, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You bet. See you later.
All right, that's Annie Rogers, and we will take a break. Back after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Busy week in the world of conference realignment, with USC and UCLA bolting for the Big Ten last week. We now wait to see what the knock-on effect is for the rest of college football and college athletics in general. Here's ESPN's Trevor Maddich on the matter.
You'll see the SEC, I believe, and the Big Ten continue to add teams, have their own playoff, like the AFC and the NFC and the NFL, have their own national championship game, and force the creation of another tier of college football for everybody else below them, because those people will not be involved in the new national championship playoff series.
So what does that mean for everybody else? You know, what does that mean? If that is the true way forward in college football, what does that mean for Kansas? What does that mean for Kansas State? What does that mean for Iowa State? You know, this is the existential fear that we around here all feel going forward. And how much is it going to matter if you have a good football program, as if Trevor Maddich, and he's not the only one predicting this is where things are headed with the SEC and the Big Ten. Where does it leave teams, and how important is it to have your football, you know, program on solid footing? How soon will this happen? If you're the University of Kansas, I'm optimistic about Lance Leipold. I think they've got a good coach. I think they finally went out and hired a real football coach instead of somebody who's going to try to sell his past accomplishments to get recruits to come to the University of Kansas. They went out and got a real football coach this time, which is what I think that Leipold is. So let's say that he does get this thing back on the right footing. Let's say the administration's able to renovate the football stadium and generate a little more enthusiasm for Kansas football and be able to package itself as you're not getting a joke of a football program if you bring us into your conference. How attractive does that actually make Kansas to that scenario? If what Trevor Maddich is saying is true, how attractive is Kansas to that scenario? My answer is not very. If you're Kansas State, you can look at it and say, hey, we've been good at football for decades now. We got a real tradition. We sell out our stadium. We go to bowl games. We've proven now, and we'll see where the Chris Klieman era goes down the road. But he's shown that this is more than just a one program coach now. They can still win games even after Bill Snyder's gone, right? That's big. You've done all that. So how attractive does that make you in this scenario? And my answer is not very. I hate that. I hate that for college athletics. I think you're looking at a lot of programs that are good, solid programs, or programs that are capable of being good, solid programs that will just get frozen out by this. And I can see why the SEC and the Big Ten want to do it. Let's just get the biggest market. Let's just get the biggest programs into our little group and get everybody else out. We don't have to share any money with them. The TV markets will make the deals just as big as they were if they had them or not. Like, they're not going to lose anything out of their TV budgets if KU and K-State aren't involved. If they've got all the big markets from coast, from sea to shining sea, and all the big programs locked in, they just have, you know, less money to share with everybody else and keep it all for ourselves. And then everybody else is left to be play in this now, what, middle tier between FCS and FBS? Let's hear from Trevor Maddich some more here. How do we get to this point in college football?
What has happened to bring us to this point is that individual teams and conferences have decided to do what's best for them. Mm-hmm. Nick Saban has been one of those voices saying that we must do what's right for all of college football. You know, all 130 or so teams in the FBS, we've got to make sure that we include them in what we're doing here in order for college football itself as a whole to be as healthy as it can be. But that's not what has happened. What has happened is they've said, this is best for me, and this is what I'm going to do. That being the case, they might as well play it out that way.
That's a little bit of a mirror of our society, right? Every man for himself. I mean, that's a little bit of what we kind of built this whole thing on, right?
Absolutely. Capitalism.
Yeah, capitalism. Every man for himself. Do what's best for you. And in the end, we'll all be better for it. There's times when that helps. There's times when it really wrecks things. And at the end of the day, each one of these schools is acting in their own best interest. You know, UCLA and USC were part of this alliance between the Big Ten and the Pac-12. Those two conferences were part of this alliance. They've got a relationship that goes back however many hundred years, which is why we still got to have the Rose Bowl, which is why we had to keep the BCS involved for as long as we did, because the Pac-12 and the Big Ten were so tied together, and the Big Ten just poached a team from the Pac-12. So that's where we stand here. Here's college football writer from The Athletic, Nicole Auerbach, about where the Pac-12 tries to go from now. Do they try to add some teams to backfill the loss of UCLA and USC?
I think it makes all the sense in the world. The Pac-12 is committing to trying to expand. Again, I think San Diego State, Boise State, those types of schools make a lot of sense for them. And then again, you decide, are you going to make a run at some of the Western or Texas schools in the Big 12?
So do they make a run at those schools in the Big 12, or do the Big 12 go make a run at those schools in the Pac-12? Which conference is more desirable right now? Is either of them? Everybody that's not the Big 10 and SEC is in trouble, and they know it. And think about the names that you just heard her say they're looking to add, they could look to add in the Pac-12. Are they on the same level as USC and UCLA when it comes to market penetration and all that stuff? Of course not. Look at the Big 12 when Texas and Oklahoma go, bringing in Cincinnati and Houston and UCF. You can give all the reasons those are great additions to your league, sure. But is anybody going to sit there and claim that they're on the same level as Texas and Oklahoma when it comes to the stuff that these conferences are after? Yeah, Texas doesn't win. Houston and Cincinnati win in football right now. But Texas has something that those schools can't get by winning. 100,000-seat stadium and the whole state of Texas watching their games. And you can see why, to go back to what Trevor Maddich had to say, that Texas is all for cutting out teams like Cincinnati and Houston and Baylor and TCU. We don't have to compete with them anymore. If we just freeze them out and have our own little super league here, we don't have to compete with them, and we take even more money. I don't know, man. I don't know where that leaves us with college football going forward in this specific area. Missouri's in the SEC. Maybe every once in a while they'll be able to really compete for those highest trophies. But at least they're in the game. They can tell you that. When all this conference realignment stuff happened, at least they can say, hey, everybody here in town is mad at us for leaving. Well, look at you now. We'll take a break. Back after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB and 38 The Spot.